This is the battle to try to restore medicine to its original purpose.
The goal of all of this is just central to what we do. I mean, we're trying to help patients.
This is my favorite conference I've ever been to, and I've been practicing for 25 years.
This is the population of people that is creating a functional healthcare system parallel to the healthcare system that has failed us.
Welcome to the FLCCC Weekly Update. I'm Betsy Ashton, creative director of this alliance of medical professionals and their supporters, and you have to join us for our third conference out in Phoenix this time. Why? Because you're the kind of people who like to fix things, like to get things right, and that's exactly who we are. You know, we came together to save lives in a raging pandemic when it was raging in New York City. And our doctors who knew how to save lives against COVID and were doing it saw something very, very wrong in the way the medical establishment was dealing with it. Patients were being denied inexpensive, readily available treatments in hospitals that could have saved them. And so they died. And the doctors who were so stunned, who spoke up to complain, were pushed aside, lost their jobs, lost their careers. And so this past weekend, as we all honored our veterans, we thought it a good time to focus on the medical care we give to the men and women in the military who put their lives on the line for the rest of us all the time for our safety in a world that has become more dangerous than it's been in decades. So, welcome Lieutenant Colonel Teresa Long, who needed and got whistleblower status after raising concerns about damage she witnessed in the otherwise exceedingly healthy and fit pilots whose care she managed, damage that only showed up after they'd received mRNA COVID vaccines. And welcome to Lieutenant Colonel Pete Chambers, a decorated combat veteran who went to medical school, graduated, and worked as an emergency room physician before re-enlisting after 9/11. He's been a special operations flight surgeon and a Green Beret officer all over the world, but he was forced into retirement for getting informed consents for his troops prior to COVID vaccinations. These two doctors care about their patients the way our doctors Paul Merrick and Pierre Corey have always done, and the rest of the doctors that have joined the FLCCC from all over the world. We can't welcome you enough. We want to say, you know, you have, one of you, Dr. Long, you have an important disclaimer that you'd like to share with our audience before we get into any further discussion. So please go ahead.
Yes, my name is Lieutenant Colonel Teresa Long, and my views are my own. They do not reflect that of the United States Army, the DOD, or any entity thereof. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's bring in Paul and Pierre. The doctors are going to have a discussion. You're going to want it. This is going to be interesting. We have our nurses on the line already to take questions that you folks at home type into your Q&A. I will come back with some of those questions for our doctors. But in the meantime, this is going to be a good discussion. So welcome. Take it away, Pierre.
Hey, Pete. Hey, Teresa. Good to see you guys.
Hey, Pierre. Hey, Pierre.
Yeah, I just saw Pete this weekend at the Ocala conference. So anyway, where do we start? You guys want to give us the update on, you know, let me just kind of lay it out. I mean, Teresa, you've been a whistleblower trying to call attention to the impacts that, obviously, you're at the FLCC webinar right now. All of our followers are well educated on the extent of the impacts of the vaccines on really all of society. Military is of particular interest to all of us, right? And you guys are on the inside. And you saw it early. You guys were one of the few, the tiny minority that spoke out, just like us out here in the general population. There's very few by number that really spoke out publicly. And you know, maybe since that time, you want to tell us what you're seeing, what's changed, what recognition interventions are going on?
Sure. And thank you, Pierre, for having me and Dr. Merrick. Pleasure to be on with you. So since then, we have seen a really shocking increase in the complexity and the nature of illnesses that we're seeing in our previously healthy population. To give you an example, you know, when I stepped into my position, there was about 32 people that, you know, were out of training for medical reasons, and probably about 70% of those were behavioral health and musculoskeletal reasons, and one person that could no longer serve and had to be go out through a medical board. And that number has since just about doubled, and with a huge swing from the number of behavioral health and musculoskeletal, you know, significantly decreasing, but we're seeing is this huge uptick in neurologic, cardiac events, autoimmune diseases, cancers. And I would tell you, I'm personally aware of five people who've had strokes, five pilots who have had strokes. And probably the most shocking for me is that in the last five events that I've seen that are cardiac arrest or a myocarditis, not myocarditis, myocardial infarction or stroke, that what you're finding in people is that they were some of the first people to be vaccinated in, you know, January 2021. And that for me is terrifying, that, you know, people think they're out of the woods and they think that, you know, I got vaccinated back in 21, I'm good to go. And that's not the case. And mind you, when I talk about these things, I field phone calls from all across the DOD, pretty much on a daily basis. So, when I talk about things, I'm not talking about necessarily one population in particular. So, but active duty service members nonetheless. So this is deeply concerning to me, and I've seen throughout this a pattern of people with their complete blood cell counts or their CBCs. I have never seen so many abnormal CBCs in my entire career. And they are not shockingly abnormal. They're just suppressed. They're suppressed white blood cell count, suppressed neutrophils, suppressed lymphocytes, and elevated platelets or low platelets, elevated liver enzymes. And you kind of look at this pattern and you know what to make of it, because it's for the first time, I've probably viewed tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of CBCs in my career. And for the most part, the only time you would see an abnormal CBC is if someone was bleeding out, or you had a female who had a heavy menstrual cycle and they were anemic, had some kind of anemia. But now all of a sudden, it's almost the same pattern of immune suppression. And you know, I've seen those people where you don't know what to make of it. You don't know what to make of it. And then all of a sudden they have myasthenia gravis, or they have some weird autoimmune disorder. And, you know, I personally have pretty significant concerns that we are just heading into a tsunami of,
So Teresa, what you're saying is that many of these events are many, many months after the original vaccination. Is that true?
Right. So some of the, you know, some of the big events, the strokes and cardiac issues, are coming on 2 years later. And so I'm constantly looking to see what were the indicators that this was coming on. Was this someone who's been having chest pain for, you know, the last year, and then all of a sudden they have a heart attack? And the scary thing is, no, you know, you kind of look at these things, and sometimes it's been just small things, you know, migraine headaches and surging blood pressures is another one that scares me to death. I see a lot of it. I see a lot of kidney stones that precede something, you know, they had kidney stones 1 year, and then boom, 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 go down the line and we find a blood clot, or we find cancer.
So what's the average age? I mean, how large is the population that you're sort of overseeing at your base, or your kind of patient population?
About 3,600 to 4,000.
And average age?
24.
Yeah. So young, super healthy people, really fit. I mean, these are some of the fittest that you can imagine, I would assume. And they're pilots, so they have to be in really good health to obtain clearance to fly, right?
Right. So I always say that, you know, that's kind of an epidemiologist dream, is that you have the United States population, and then you have 1.4 million people who are selected from that U.S. population for their health. They're healthy enough to be in the military. And then you have a smaller subset that has to pass the most stringent physical standards to be pilots.
Mm.
And that is the group of people that myself and Dr. Chambers are qualified to take care of. And so I think the interesting shift is that people who are generally flight surgeons that function in this position are used to seeing very healthy people. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, it's kind of dangerous in medicine when you get so used to seeing healthy, right? And then when you see someone who's not healthy, sometimes you either don't catch it because you're just not paying attention, or you're just not used to seeing sick people. So I've seen plenty where, you know, they for like a year, they know something's wrong. They're complaining, but people aren't really taking them serious. People are just kind of blowing off that weakness or that headache. And I think that's a big thing, is that a lot of providers, if you don't understand where this vaccine goes and you don't understand the spike protein damage it can cause, you're completely blind. This is a huge paradigm shift in medicine. Whereas, you know, for 10 years in medicine, I was out, you know, in Texas seeing young, healthy people. And if a 22 or 24-year-old came in and told me they had chest pain, I didn't rush them off to the cath lab or anything. You kind of went, oh, costochondritis, you know, they're doing too many pushups. Now, like, the hair stands up on the back of my neck, and I can't explain. And all these people, young, healthy people in their 20s, all of a sudden they got a blood pressure of 160 over 100, and their providers are just putting them on multiple blood pressure medications, and no one's stopping and saying, why the hell is this 24-year-old have this acute onset of high blood pressure? Can we bring it down? Yes, we can bring it down. But there's something else going on.
I would presume most of the providers aren't connecting the dots and linking the, you know, presenting symptomatology to the vaccine, or dismissing the role of the vaccine.
I would tell you that that the thought that the vaccine is causing harm is a different world you walk into, where people are still chanting safe and effective. And, you know, no matter how much literature you bring to people, they refuse to see it, or they don't want to see it. They don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, that's been a case.
And I suppose it's very difficult otherwise to explain the illnesses you're seeing in otherwise healthy young people. Why should this be happening?
Well, I've had several now where I've caught several, you know, two cases of MS and myasthenia gravis and weird lupus. And as like the providers, it never even crossed their mind that this was something bigger. But if you listen to these guys, they'll tell you. You know, a good professor in medicine used to always tell me, if you'll just shut up long enough,
yep,
right, the patient will tell you exactly what's wrong with them.
Yep.
And for my guys and men and women, they want to fly so bad that if they come in and they tell us something, they kind of know it's going to prevent them from doing what they want to do.
So that actually really, I've thought of that. And you know, young, healthy guys, they've committed their entire careers, their military careers, they, you know, they want to fly. And they know if they start going in and telling you what's really going on, that they're going to put their careers and their everything they've worked for at risk. And young men or young people in general are pretty stoic and don't always complain a lot. And here now they have an incentive to really keep it to themselves.
So I just 2 days ago, I had a text message from a guy said, "Hey, I friend of this person, and they said you could help me." And I got on the phone with him, and he said, "Hey, I fly really high performance military aircraft. I won't say which one. And I had a heart attack and I've been permanently grounded and I want to talk to you about it." So, okay. And he said, this blew me away. He said, "They pulled a clot the entire length of my left anterior descending out of my heart." And he just had 2 out of 10 chest pain for a few hours and finally went in. Unbelievable.
How old was this patient?
34.
Yep. Wow.
And so hold on, Pete, you want to tell us about kind of what you've seen and, sure, and what's going on with you and your experience? So
bear in mind, I retired last year in May.
Okay.
So I don't have anything current, but what I did have was a cohort study, if you will, empiric derived. As I was a task force surgeon on Operation Lone Star, which is on our Texas-Mexico border right over there. And I had 5,000 soldiers under me. I was the task force surgeon, and it was my job to keep them the readiness level to man the outposts along 1,250 miles of Texas border. Age group, same as Teresa's, fittest people in the world. So I had a combination of infantry guys, paratroopers, and Green Berets. Green Berets being the most fit, definitely similar to a flight status person. So now we're looking at that, and I had a vaccination rate in the beginning of this thing, before the mandates came to the military. In the beginning, less than 10% vaccination rate. These are young people. There'd be no reason for them to take it. They come to the border, and now at this point, and this is a really good story because I wanted to tell you this. The other day, we didn't have time to talk much. I'm looking at my very first case of myocarditis / pericarditis in a 27-year-old soldier that had come down from the North Dakota National Guard to help us to volunteer down here. And he had just received his vaccine a week before he showed up on the border. As soon as he showed up on the line, crushing chest pain. Now, the way it works for me as an operational guy is I could be 1,250 miles away. They call me and say, "Hey, we got a guy down here, chest pain." So I'm triaging on the phone. And yep, I send him over to McAllen Heart Hospital, and then I'll get back over there when I can and we'll follow up. And by the time I make it back, he's already comfortable. He's in the bed. They have the diagnosis, straight up myopericarditis. Well, he had received his shots. And at this point, I'm thinking, in my whole career from 2003, and I came in the Army in 83 as an enlisted guy, but as a doctor from 2003 until 2022, I've had one tombstone-like, you know, stint. Mm. Okay, one of a 52-year-old master sergeant that was overweight. Okay, that was it. And it happened. I mean, that you're going to see that. But typically in my group, Green Berets, pretty healthy. But, you know, that guy was just kind of a desk guy, and that happened.
Now, Pete, you want to tell our listeners, what a tombstone is?
Yeah. So it's a tombstone because it's you know, usually associated with end of life. But this guy, we got him out. We were in Afghanistan when it happened, by the way. We got him to Germany and we saved him. And he's out. But But the way that the EKG looks, the way the shape of it is like a tombstone. You know, your normal EKG looks like, you know, squiggly lines. We call it the PQRST. Well, this thing goes up, and when it gets into that to that phase where it should just be a straight line, it literally lifts up and it turns into a big arc, and it looks yep. like a tombstone. And when I see that as an ER guy, that's usually time for me to start intervening pretty quickly. Anyway, now I'm seeing these things, you know, the cases on the border out of 5,000 troops, I had 18 cases of soldiers in that same age group of just chest pain, nonspecific. All right. Well, then it was narrowed down. I ended up with six that were diagnosed that I knew about, that I saw their diagnosis from the emergency rooms that they went to, because I didn't have that kind of facility. I had a level, you know, a battalion aid station level treatment facilities along the border. And usually they just went straight to the emergency room. All right. Now, then I started getting neurologic, and they were coming in different batches. So as the different batches were being given, I would start looking at this stuff and wondering, okay, as I'm watching VAERS data on the civilian side, paying attention to that. And then Teresa Long and myself started talking around this same time. And she said, have you seen the DMED data, the Defense Medical Epidemiology Database, the most accurate system at the time for reporting, because it's based upon a international code for diagnosis and a visit to a military medical treatment facility. So the provider sees the patient, puts it down one for one every time they come in now. But these numbers are derived and very objective in nature. So now we're looking at this information. She says, look at the DMED. Well, I didn't have the system down at 5 hours south on the border. So I went back up to Austin, got on the system and said, whoa, the first one I saw, neurologic disorder, 11X rise. Okay, so now it's backing up what I'm seeing on the ground. But that system was created to be a sentinel event indicator. It was created to say, hey guys, warning, you know, Will Rogers.
Just like VAERS, Pete, just like VAERS.
Rog? Okay, so now I'm seeing that. And I go to my command and say, hey, you know, and I have less than 10%, but now here comes the warning order. And the warning order says you will vaccinate every soldier. This comes from the Department of Defense to the Texas Military Department and then to me. And I'm the task force surgeon. I got the biggest operation going on operational continental United States at the time, the biggest operation. There's never been that many troops on that border since back in the days of the Pancho Villa. So now I'm charged also with the command level to make sure that the readiness is up to par. So the way that the command looked at readiness was, we need 100% vaxxed. I don't care. They don't need it, doc. 100% vaxxed. That's their number, because their status, the standard. My standard is the Army regulations. And in the Army regulations, it's Chapter 8 of 40-562. It says, if this is an emergency use authorization, you must do informed consents. I did informed consents. I would let them set up their shot stations down there in the big bays. And I'd wait, and then I'd walk up and I'd look at the vial and they'd say, well, no, it's approved. It's the same. It's EUA is the same as basic licensure agreement, a BLA. It's the same. I say, well, this is not approved. Pack it up, send it back to Austin. And they would drive their 5 hours back up to Austin. Well, I outranked every one of them. Where I lost the game of rock, paper, rank, right? Because there's a game, rock, paper, rank, is when a two-star general came down with the next crew to set up the shots. And a two-star general, the division commander, and I bring him into my office. I know he's coming. I've got the stats on the board. Look, my sick call is filled up with people that are double vaxxed. I don't have anybody sick otherwise because we're doing prevention. And I was quoting things that you were saying early on. I was quoting things that you, Pierre. I was quoting things that McCullough was saying. Even Del Bigtree had something out there about trying to explain this in a football analogy for my troops. Because remember, you know, I was an infantry guy too. These guys are trained, they're not the, you know, it's not that they're not the brightest. They just don't have the information. Anyway, who else? Ryan Cole, another one. Lee Merritt. So I'm making an informed consent brief that is just eloquent, 90 pages of PowerPoint. And they're watching like about 30 that I had lifted up for them with the supporting documentation for the rest of it. And the command says, stop doing informed consents. Unless you can recuse yourself and convince the soldiers to take it, stop. This was testified in Seals versus Lloyd Austin when Teresa Long and I were down there in Tampa with Matt Staver. Stop doing that. Well, that's an unlawful order, sir. I mean, that's what I had to say to the two-star, respectfully. And he said, it ain't about the science. It's about the policy.
Hmm.
Straight up. So and when I said it was an unlawful order and there was a one-star standing behind him and a colonel standing behind him, because they ganged up on me. And I said, that's unlawful, sir. You see the wrath of a two-star show up when his face turns red and says, you're done with this job down here. We'll get a replacement down here. And the guy that replaced me, smartest guy in the world on paper, no common sense. He was going to do two things. He was going to talk to him about toxic masculinity, and he was going to give him a shot on everything. Everyone.
Wow.
So what you're saying then is that there was 100% vaccination rate.
No. So what happened then when I left, and I was sitting right around 10%, just under 10%. When I left, the mandate showed up and the vaccination rate went up to 76% on that particular cohort of soldiers. And then at that point, then they started seeing they had a rash of soldiers found unresponsive in their rooms, in the hotel rooms, because they were using hotel rooms sometimes for putting people up on the border. So they explained that away as a heat casualty. However, they didn't wake up in the morning. They weren't that hot. So there were no autopsies. Look, when I worked the emergency room back in the late 90s. And
so you're telling us that there were soldiers who actually died from the vaccine. Is that what you're saying?
I could not prove that myself, and I didn't go and see them, and I didn't do an autopsy, but we don't typically have that happen.
I was going to say, if you don't have how many deaths have you seen outside of battle?
Let's just say out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, well, you name it, on the border, when I'm taking care of guys, we do preventative medicine. Sometimes they have heat injuries. I've had a heat injury. I've been, you know, close to a heat stroke. But, you know, we go through protocols to take care of this stuff. And as an emergency room guy, we treat it. But we don't just let them go to their room and die if it's heat injury. But we're talking about guys that were in their rooms all night. It was just written off as that so we could have a diagnosis.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yes, sir.
And so, these are young, fit men.
The first one was 30 years old.
So
very fit.
Pierre, I'd like to address this because this is a falsehood that keeps floating around, that the DMED is, you know, was never correct. When Pete and I ran that data, I'm on such a small insulation that you could literally run reports based off of your location.
Mm.
So if you have a small population and you know that you have a case of lymphoma and colon cancer and thyroid cancer, and you know these specific diagnoses, and I used to be able to go in and run the reports and verify what I know to be true on post, right? Before they changed all the data, I could literally say, yep, there's the two brain tumors, or there's the this and that. Since that data has been tampered with, that is no longer true. So when people come out and they say, oh, you know, the data was, you know, fake, or it wasn't real, or it whatever, like, they don't know what they're talking about, because Pete and I and Sam and Mark did an extensive amount of pulling reports and looking at things we could verify against other reports and we knew to be true. And now you can't do that. Nothing lines up. But one thing that did happen is, even in the Seals court case, even after all the hocus pocus, they had to admit that there was like a 37% increase in pulmonary embolisms, a 27% increase in esophageal cancer, and I think it was like a 27% increase in ovarian dysfunction. Just that, right? If we don't agree, and 151% increase in myocarditis. So if we throw out the whole rest of the database and we just say, this new drug came out and we have 151% increase in myocarditis and a 37%, Pete, was it 37? Something like
37,
that.
Yes, ma'am.
percent increase in pulmonary embolisms. Would you two gentlemen not agree that that in and of itself is enough to say full stop?
Yeah, well, especially if you would look at the difference between 2019 and 2020, looking for those changes and then compare 2020 to 21, because if it was all, because, you know, what we've seen is public health agencies all across the world blaming everything on COVID. You know, that's the shroud that buries this catastrophe driven by the vaccine. But if you look, if COVID was the primary cause of myocarditis, you would have seen that spike in 2020, but you only see it show up in 2021. Am I correct?
Yes.
So in the data? Yeah,
that was absolutely true. And I wanted to answer someone's question about how they changed the data. So the way you could tell that the data was manipulated is 2016 to 2020 pulmonary embolisms, right? And you and I know that you can take the incidence of pulmonary embolisms and calculate based off of 1.4 million active duty service members how many pulmonary embolisms you should get. I want to say it was somewhere in the nature of 700. Okay. And 2021 was something like 3,400.
Mm.
And what they did is they went back in the data and they elevated the numbers of 2016 to 2020 so that it was like 4,200, 5,000, 4,500. So you really want me to believe that we had an absolute outbreak of we had a rate of pulmonary embolisms in the military like 10 times the national average, right? This whole time. And we as providers were never told, like, there's something weird in the military population. We just throw blood clots to the lungs left and right. So what they did is they elevated 2016 to 2020 numbers so high that it made 2021 look like the vaccine cured everything, including Guillain-Barré, Bell's palsy, and anaphylaxis. So if you really believe that close to like 1.2 million soldiers received two shots and the incidence of anaphylaxis went down, the incidence of Bell's palsy went down, Guillain-Barré went down. Like, that's crazy. Even those are things that we all agree should naturally go up if you give everyone in the military 100%. Two doses of penicillin, right?
Yeah.
Or anything else. And so that's how it was absurd. And we could do the same thing with HIV. HIV is very closely tracked in the military. They have congressional reports on how many cases we had, and they did the same thing. And they wanted people to believe that we've always had like 2,500 to 3,000 cases a year of HIV, when in fact the congressional record showed that the 2019, it was reported that we had like, I think, 350 cases.
Wow.
So,
you know, Teresa, one question, I guess another data question, which I think would be much more accurate, but when you started, you said like typically you had, I think, 32, in your patient or military population that you're in charge of, 32 were on like injured reserve. Well, I don't know what you call it when you're can't fly or whatever on injury something
profile.
Injury, yeah, profile.
They're on close hold.
And that doubled. But how many people have had to leave the military? So I understand there's deaths.
Roughly about half.
On medical discharge, kind of. Is there a medical discharge?
So that, I mean, yes. And this is a problem I'm seeing is that typically, if a pilot doesn't meet flight standards, we go, that stinks, but you can go be an artilleryman or you can go be an infantryman. You know, you can take that medication and go do that thing, but you can't take it when you fly. But when you're seeing where it's like, no, you're not fit for service at all.
Mm.
You can't, there's
how many situations you've been in where you've had to tell a soldier you're not fit for any role in the military compared to in the last year or two?
Well, I think I'm uniquely positioned to answer this because for 3 years, I adjudicated over 500 medical board cases. And so therefore I sat there and determined that someone couldn't serve. And I would tell you about 85% of those were due to a musculoskeletal injury, predominantly lower back problems, knee problems, shoulder problems. And so I know, and then it would just be kind of like a one-off if you ever saw someone with MS, or a one-off if I never saw anybody with strokes, I never saw anybody with DVTs that wasn't associated with like some, you know, they were blown up in Iraq and they were in 18 hours of surgery and then they had a PE or something. But in those 500 cases, I maybe had one cancer and maybe a small handful of autoimmune diseases. And now it's like, I mean, I hate to say it, but in my group of people that I run with on a daily basis, I'm like, oh, we've got this rare form of, and they're like, you guys are like the zebra of zebras, right? You guys, all of a sudden, and you have to say statistically, what are the odds of me having, oh, I don't know, 60 extremely rare events in one small population? Or how about 10? What's the chance of having like, you know, two fatal neurodegenerative diseases in one small
group?
And Teresa, are you seeing cancer in these young men?
Yeah. So a lot of testicular cancer, colon cancer. I think the guy was like 20 or something.
So, you know, that's interesting because colorectal cancer is a disease, is extremely rare in young people.
Yes.
It's a disease of middle and elderly age. So the fact that you're seeing colorectal cancer in young men in itself should be a very big red flag.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, so seeing that, so, you know, spinal tumor that came out of nowhere, you see these things. And I, when I tell you that,
what happens to these servicemen, where do they get sent to? Are they discharged? Are they given care? I mean,
it just depends on where they're stationed and, you know, with whether the military has a robust hospital that can take care of them and get their specialty care. We only have a small clinic at our post, so we don't have any specialty care. So everybody gets sent out to the civilian sector. But you laugh, but when someone you know tears an ACL or sprains an ankle, like I rejoice. I'm like, that can be fixed.
Yeah,
but. Yeah. On the other side of that, you know, I had a guy saying, hey, I got to go in for hip surgery. And I'm very concerned that he could end up with a blood clot. And this is, you know, and I don't take it lightly, cases where people go in for shoulder surgery and the next thing you know, they're dead from a pulmonary embolism. I've seen a individual who had was playing volleyball and kind of landed hard on his heels and fractured his cuboid bone. Every orthopedic person I talked to said there's no way you get a blood clot from that fracture. It didn't require surgery. They put him in a CAM boot. He admitted that he was not compliant with the use of his CAM boot. And he ended up with a 12-centimeter blood clot in his leg.
Which, Teresa, if he was not compliant, that would have lowered his risk of getting a DVT.
That's right.
More mobile and flexible. So, you know, it's not like he was strapped into a CAM boot, you know, immobile, and he still got a huge clot. And let me ask you another question. Have there been incidents or events in flight?
Yeah. You know, that's a big concern. And I'll leave
that
it.
Is the concern with that, that's your job, right? Is it, that's essentially the core of your job, is to make sure that.
Want me to answer that for you, Teresa?
Yeah.
I would tell you this, Pierre, that the unfortunate thing in aircraft mishap investigations, you have to have enough of a human being's body left to actually ascertain what happened. And that's not always possible. So.
Doc, you are going to answer the question?
Yeah.
Well, because she has a lot more pressure on her than I do. Yeah, I'm out of uniform. She's not. But she should probably be investigating every one of these aircraft mishaps that have taken place at Fort Rucker, particularly with this particular cohort of students. When you see an instructor pilot have to bring it to the ground for a student that just passed out in the seat, or when I drive to Dallas and see Bob Snow after he walked off the deck, this was an airline pilot with American Airlines. And I was asked to go there. I was actually with Leave Leap when that happened. And I had to hightail it all the way back to, she's in Arizona, by the way, and get up to Dallas to meet him in the ICU and got him taken care of. And that was a combined effort between Josh Yoder, Peter McCullough, and myself. So, you know, he coded as he got up, as he landed the plane, he coded. And luckily there was a corpsman on board, did CPR, AED. AEDs, let me explain something about that. This is an interesting finding, this just recently. I still talk to the guys in uniform on the border. The Operation Lone Star is still underway. The large shipment of AEDs showed up on the border. And then I started questioning other people in other units around the country. And that is a new piece of equipment that's putting in the TONE and in the equipment lists of the units. Don't ever, we didn't need AEDs, I'm sorry. Before we had our, you know, our life pack 12s if we needed those in the aid station, but now they have to be up all around the training areas just in case these fit soldiers have a cardiac event.
That's matched by a lot of reports I get. You know, people write to me, like some of my subscribers on my Substack. I mean, they say that in their workplaces, different camps, schools, you know, posters about cardiac arrest, more AEDs are showing up. I mean, that is, you know, but in the context of the military, it's like, yeah, they want to go to 100%. So they want to get everyone vaccinated. And then their response is to just put out, I mean, you know, very crude way of looking at that. Then they'll just put out more AEDs. It sounds somewhat military.
Well, I could tell you that I think the request for training on AEDs has gone up exponentially, and all of a sudden people are very serious about that. And just that person I told you had the left anterior descending. This is a person that flies a high performance, very I just can't even tell you what kind of aircraft they fly, but no wiggle room whatsoever for some kind of an event to occur. If you have helicopters and or jets flying in formation, there's no wiggle room for someone to, you know, pass out momentarily at the stick or you know, have a medical event. And in fact, I saw today put out on Twitter was that an Army officer died running just 2 days ago.
Yep. I a couple of things on that. This soldier who had this huge LED clot, career is over. Okay. I have a similar case. I have a 26-year-old who saw me, was a police officer, but really wanted to be a firefighter. And was training very hard for it to be a firefighter. This is about 6 months after the vaccine, chest pain, sweating, went in, huge LED clot. The cardiologist, the interventional cardiologist, told him that he couldn't actually stent it open all the way because it was so firm. And he was afraid of rupturing the coronary artery. And then he goes on an anticoagulant, you know, for the typical, whatever, 3 to 6 months. And they decided to take him off. And 6 weeks later, he has a huge clot in his ulnar artery. I've never heard of a 26-year-old with a huge, and they actually took it out, have the picture and everything. But I mean, we see that stuff all the time, but in the military, you have a big heart attack. I mean, your aviation's career is over, and also infantry, artillery, all of that. You're not going to be a soldier anymore. Is that right?
That's right.
Well, I mean, if you have sudden cardiac death, you're going to get a defibrillator, and that is not really simpatico with radio frequency jamming equipment and other things. So that's an automatic out. And the kid with the clot in his leg, they put him on Xarelto Eliquis. Yeah. The clot got bigger. And so, he told me that he started taking natokinase, and within a month it was gone.
Yes. So I have, let me add one more to that. So I have actually a pediatrician patient of mine who started getting numerous SVTs, so superficial vein thromboses, but painful. They kept repeating. She got it on standard dose Eliquis. They went up, they switched to warfarin. They kept her on a higher range, still got clots. And then she, I think, ended up on like 1.5 times the dose of Eliquis, and then it seemed to stop. But that's not normal. It's very rare for someone to get a clot on anticoagulation. And I know of a number of cases since the vaccine's come out.
Yeah. And, you know, you just look at these strokes and 24-year-olds, 22-year-olds, 29-year-old. And I will say this, though, I'll get your guys' opinion on this. I have personally seen where people want to get genetic testing on these people because they want it. These doctors want to blame it on something other than the vaccine. And it's my position that can be, I don't think most people realize that if that test, you know, comes back positive, then maybe your disability would be disapproved because it's a pre-existing condition, a congenital condition. But I look at that and same thing with VAERS reports. You know, you got to wonder if you file a VAERS report, will that someday be used to deny an insurance claim? I think you guys might find it funny, not funny. You probably can't see this. I got notification today by VAERS, and they let me know that I filed a report a year ago, and they're now reaching out to me. And 2 weeks ago, I had them reach out to me on the very first VAERS report I ever filed back in 2021. And when I said to the gentleman, I said, what the hell? I mean, this is the very first VAERS report I filed on a case of myocarditis. And the guy said, I'm sorry, we're just now getting to September of 2021.
Not surprising.
I need to jump in here. This is
before you do, Betsy. Yeah. I just want to ask Teresa a question. Are they boosting? Are the troops being boosted?
It is not mandatory, but you know, the problem I see is these kids are going through basic training. They know nothing about nothing, right? And they stand in a line, and boom, 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 boom. They literally walk down a line where they're getting shot after shot after shot. And, you know, no one's standing there saying, would you like a religious exemption for the COVID shot? Would you like to opt out? Like, they don't know anything about opting out of immunizations. And I have to say this, you know, one gentleman I saw had come right out of that, didn't even look like he's old enough to shave yet, and gets turbo lymphoma and acute heart failure. And we don't know the effect of giving, you know, 10 different vaccinations at once in people who are in a physiologically intensive environment, you know, with sleep deprivation and everything else. And I just think it's incredibly reckless to even offer it. I mean, it should be off the shelves. It shouldn't even be an option. It's like, you know, do we sell cyanide? You know, and hey, if people want to take it, they want to take it. You're like, no, this is dangerous and deadly, and it shouldn't be offered. And you see these warnings coming out from the CDC about the combination of flu and COVID. And, you know, personally, before this period of time, I rarely ever saw people have adverse events from flu shots. And now it seems like it's a problem. Mm. Are you seeing that?
No, my patient population is so sick and so injured from largely from vaccines that no one's looking for flu shots. So I don't have, and none of my beautiful network of ever expanding colleagues, even in this country around the world, are getting flu shots. So I'm not getting any direct experience from that. But
we do have a spike in a certain type of diagnosis now. It's interesting because it's only in the rank of colonel and above to general, and it is called moral injury.
Mm.
What? Right?
Moral injury, morality, personal courage.
And let me guess, it's asymptomatic. They don't feel it yet.
That's right. They haven't noticed it yet.
Yeah.
They're the ones that are they're calling the shots, and they will not allow doctors like Dr. Long here and myself before I got out to say anything about it. It's too sensitive. I went to a congressman. It was too sensitive. We don't want to talk about that. I finally got to Senator Johnson and we were able to get it started. But that's the morality, that injury is something that needs to be addressed.
It would require taking responsibility that you put out an order, right, that caused direct injury and or death in those under your charge. And I think there's a huge psychological and moral, it's cowardice, really.
It is cowardice. Well,
I will say this, that it's actually written into our regulation on immunization and prophylaxis, that the VAERS system is our safety system of record, meaning that when the little red light is blinking, you should be taking action. And the response has essentially been put duct tape over the blinking light and say, you don't see a blinking light.
Saying alter the data, which is
right. So never in aviation would we cut our master caution light and say whatever. I mean, I would never approach an aircraft and the crew chief on the aircraft go, or the maintenance guy say, oh ma'am, I wouldn't get on that thing. And I just say, you don't know what you're talking about and get on. But when you have your doctor saying, hey, like, no way, we need to step away from this. And people who aren't doctors go, yeah, whatever, we're just going to get on. That's essentially, it's so absurd. The level of indifference and the risk taking that I see going on. And right out the bat, I said, wow, this thing causes myocarditis. That's not something we can screen for. We're not going to catch that on an EKG or a simple blood test. I told them up front, this is, you're forcing us into a position where we would have to do screening cardiac MRIs to ensure aviation safety. And that, essentially told to shut up and go away. And now...
Betsy, do we have any pressing questions?
Yes, we do. We do. Yes. And the first one I want to ask you really kind of talks to the big picture. I mean, we're talking about the individuals here, but, Prabha Agastisi says, was our military weakened by forcing the injections as part of an agenda?
No doubt. No doubt.
Absolutely. 100%. National defense is in the balance right now. There are many other reasons for that, but this one here, the retention rate, people will not stay in under these commanders. They just won't. Guys like me at the lieutenant colonel rank, we are the ones that actually interface with our troops. When they reach 06 colonel rank in the operational world, they work behind a desk. They don't see their faces. They don't talk to their families when they come in, a 30-year-old with a stroke needing speech rehab. They don't see that stuff. So that's that side of it. And then the recruiting is abysmal. It is about at the level of 1973 right now. We cannot recruit. We cannot retain.
Yeah, and that's hitting the papers. I've seen a number of articles on that, right, Pete?
We want to go and fight, in multiple wars now, downrange, or Heart Wars.
What do you think the reason is for the sudden drop in recruitment? Is it a population effect that we have less?
No, I think that the people like my son, you know, of course he hears it from me, but he's been wanting to go in the military his whole life. He's 24. He finished his college now. And then when the mandates were dropped, I said, okay, well, you're a grown man. You make a decision. He wants to be a Green Beret. You know, where he got that. But he's an aerospace engineer. I'm like, you're way smarter than that, son. But he's going to go and then he'll fly after that, he said. But he waited. But his buddies, he had six that were going to go in with him. He's the only one that's going to go in now. They were all together in ROTC at their university. So they see it. They hear the stories of this moral injury that we talk about and the cowardice. Because, look, I was an infantry kid and I was a commander of Green Berets. When I was a commander of Green Berets, my job, I'm responsible for everything that happens or fails to happen. It's different. But this, the people that are above us now at those higher levels, they're irresponsible.
I would say this too. If you're vaccinating all these young people before they're even at the age where they're eligible for military service, we're already decreasing the population that was already very small to begin with. You know, you couldn't have, you know, drug charges and police arrest and stuff. And so I think that is multifactorial. People have to realize there's three components, really. There's the recruiting, there's retaining the talent we already have, and then there's the loss of people through the med board process. And so I am deeply concerned after 30 years, when I see all three of those red lights blinking, and baby, they're blinking hard, and you know it's unsustainable. And so, and now I think even more so when I see that some of the people suffering the worst consequence of these vaccines were some of the first to get them, I really do believe that we're not coming out of this. We're heading deeper into this. And I look at your protocol. I recommend your protocol. It, you know, of course, we don't do that. I don't have a mechanism for the prescription low-dose naltrexone and the ivermectin. But, you know, you look at things like natural kinase, and my objective with people is to try and get them to read that and make a decision on their own, whether or not that protocol would be helpful to them. And there's, I think the only thing I really saw on there beside the prescription medications that a pilot couldn't take is the melatonin.
I was going to ask, can they obtain those things? Because I understand there is a list of things that it's quite restrictive of what pilots can take.
Right. So the, you know, the rules are essentially if you get treated by any doctor, you have to inform your flight surgeon, and they have to look at a list of medications that you can't take. So there's self-reporting that has to go on there. And it's really tough because you sit there, I look at people all the time and I think, I really don't want them to drop dead. I really don't want to find out that they were found dead by their spouse in their bed, or they you know have cardiac arrest behind the controls of a helicopter and kill a whole bunch of people, and that helicopter crashes into a neighborhood.
Well, that's the other thing that you have to have on your mind, right? It's not only the patient before you, but it's the consequences of something happening to them is a multiplier, right? And you could
absolutely Yeah. I had a good friend who, you know, no fault of his own, lost the tail rotor off of his helicopter. So they're spinning like a top. Ugh. And let me tell you, took everything superhuman for this person who could have easily crashed in a neighborhood to land this thing in the one patch of grass where there weren't homes. And that's with someone who is in great shape and doesn't have any clots sitting somewhere in his body, that could have been a whole different story. And you see some of these, I could mention more specific ones, but some of these more recent mishaps occurred right across the street from school as it was getting out, you know, and so it's a serious business. And I take it very seriously.
You guys have painted a really bleak picture. It's not bleaker than anything we already know. But, you know, when I think of the nation's pilots having been so highly vaccinated, and then you have to consider this paper, I sent it to Paul like a week ago, it's been talked about, but where they just compared MRI findings between vaccinated and unvaccinated, just, you know, an undifferentiated population. And you could see that what's called the uptake of the contrast was on average higher, significantly higher in the vaccine. So basically you're dealing with a whole population of patients, of people who've been vaccinated that have some sort of low level inflammation in their heart. And these are the pilots we're putting into the sky.
Yes. And I spoke to Dr. McCullough, and we were talking about the question of whether someone who has myocarditis from the vaccine, the inflammation gets better, and then they at a later time get influenza where they get some other inflammatory thing going on, and it re-inflames that myocarditis. That's a big concern. You know, I was documenting, because everything's documenting, right? If a helicopter goes down, they just go back, and what you wrote is what you wrote. And I was documenting, right? This person had this many vaccines and this person said it was okay. And they didn't like that. Stop documenting people's names in the record that said it was okay. It's not going to be my name in the record, but the, you know, for every pilot, we have to attest to that. I attest this pilot does not have any increased risk of sudden incapacitation. I can't do that anymore. I cannot write that statement. And
I can't imagine the position you're in.
Yeah. Well, it's a little stressful.
Yeah.
It's a little stressful. And I, you know, I tell people on a regular basis, there's a part of me I care about, you know, soldiers being able to do their job, but I more care that they are not going to drop dead. And I more care about their family never getting a phone call, you know, not that they went into war and they got killed, but that, you know, they died from some big massive blood clot or cardiac arrest.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the attempt to document this and get something out there to a policy change, hopefully, although when somebody's fooling around with the numbers, that's another story. But, you know, Gerald Quinn, one of our viewers, says, when an event takes place, how are you able to definitively say that a shot you got 2 years ago is the cause? I mean,
so absolutely. And if you listen to Dr. Cole talk about how they can stain, unfortunately, when Dr. Cole is doing staining, it's usually an autopsy.
Yeah.
Right.
But Teresa, I think you've already kind of answered that. I think people don't understand, you know, obviously you can't be definitive without autopsy and staining for spike and seeing the focal injury caused by the spike, but you can make a very compelling, if not absolutely convincing argument, just epidemiologically, right? I mean, 30-year-olds do not get huge LAD clots in the height of fitness. 24-year-olds, 26-year-olds just don't get them. I mean, so you can safely say that it's far more likely than not that the vaccine is at a cause, because you're seeing spikes in cancers that have never really been described before at these age groups, a frequency and severity and incidence of events like strokes in young people.
That age group.
It just doesn't happen. Or I'm sorry, it does happen. It never used to happen.
Right. And it's mind numbing how I just watch people do mental gymnastics. Well, you can't prove definitive. You didn't prove definitively that this crap was safe and effective. There was no double-blinded placebo-controlled trial for 10 years that showed this wasn't going to harm people.
It's so clear, but let's bring it back to medicine, right? So medicine, when you're faced with a problem, you generate what's called a differential diagnosis, right? You use all the data at your at your disposal, and you order, you rank order the potential causes of this problem, you know, in terms of most likely to least likely. So if you want to say that your differential diagnosis, your leading diagnosis is that the vaccine is a cause, and they want to argue with that, okay, give me compelling evidence to put something in front of the vaccine as a cause. I want to go with global warming? Is that where they want to go?
Well, I will
start it in 2021.
That I'm building a list where they people will evaluate these patients based off of the pre-pandemic vaccine is safe and effective mindset, and they get the diagnosis wrong.
Yeah.
And the person comes over to me and I look and I go, leg weakness, acute onset of leg weakness, bladder problems. He's got MS. This thing went across and gave him MS, and I'm right. So the answer there is that when I approach it with the mindset that the vaccine goes these places and causes these problems, I'm doing pretty well. My batting average is pretty stellar.
I mean, all you'd have to do is talk to someone like Suzanne Gazda, one of our close clinical advisors, a neurologist. She's spoken at a conference. I mean, she has been taking care of a population of MS patients for a long time. In fact, she was going to retire early on in the pandemic, but the demand for her expertise and insights is so high. But her whole population of patients, she's never seen such kind of mass deterioration in her MS patients. Those who already have MS are much harder to treat. They're all getting worse. And and that's the most common autoimmune disease of the brain.
Yeah, and Dr. Chance in Birmingham, I sent her over a pilot that everybody had been telling us is psychosomatic, is all in his head because he had an acute onset of stuttering after vaccination and was totally gaslit. And, you know, I just sat down across from the young man and it took me 2 seconds to know, I don't know what's wrong with him, but something is terribly wrong. And she diagnoses him at 32. High elite pilot with 32 with early onset Parkinson's and 6 other neurodegenerative diseases. Like, it looked crazy to people because everything on exam was positive. Like, and you were like, how can one person have this many independent things going wrong? And so, you know, I don't know what is 3 cases of MS in a population of like 3,800. Does that seem a little high? You know, how many people have ever seen Parkinson's in someone that young?
Let's think of something potentially positive. Becky Lang says, hearing all of this makes me feel that all people who have had the vaccine should be taking something to break down the spike protein, even if they have no symptoms. What are your thoughts, doctors, anybody, on doing that?
I take natokinase just because I have never taken the vaccine. But yes, I mean, if I had my druthers, because we're doing nothing is not working.
Yeah. I want to be clear. So we have recommendations. We have a protocol called iPrevent, very safe supplements, nutraceuticals, medicines that have really good mechanisms that would counteract some of the pathophysiology that we've identified triggered by the spike. So for sure, we have theoretical and mechanistic suggestions. There's no clinical data to suggest that if you go on all these things, it might prevent an event. But I do think that they're really sound, safe, and it's prudent to do. So we can't say that everyone needs it. But, you know, hearing these events this far out from their vaccine, I'm actually pretty troubled by that. I actually just got texted by a former trainee of mine. One of the only in my huge kind of network of trainees that don't talk to me anymore. He was one of the ones who still did. And he texted me that he's really shook up in his locums intensivist group. One of their partners just arrested the other day at, I think, 48. And then he texted me again today that another partner of his partner or something, two people very close in his professional orbit arrested. I don't know how far out they were from the vaccines, but I had thought, I had been telling people that based on what we were seeing, the epidemiology and the VAERS reports, that it seemed like the baseline risk of an excess mortality cardiac event was approaching baseline at around a year. We don't have good data on that, but either these are outliers or we need to extend that window over which you have to worry about a sudden event.
Well, one thing cross my thought process is, so some people that have cancer, right? And then you see they get cachectic, they're losing weight, and then their heart starts failing. Is that because these lipids, you know, concentrated in their fats, and as those fats were broken down, maybe they got another huge spike of burst of spike protein? But I don't know. Do white people make more spike protein than black people or Asians, or males or females? But I think I was like you, Corey. I really felt like we were probably out of the woods. We're probably fine. And then to see this last handful of cases really kind of shook me up, and as it did people around me and people, because now we can't blame it on COVID, right? COVID is long gone and nobody's getting COVID. And all of a sudden you don't have that to blame the stroke or this heart attack, whatever.
Yeah, these cases that are occurring, you know, years after the vaccine are very troubling to us, you know, because we thought that the risk decreased quite substantially with time. So now, obviously, you know, Teresa, we have to rethink this whole time course.
Yeah, and I want to give people hope, because you guys are working on taking care of people, and there are things. Pete has gone through things and done things to help. And I was very encouraged to see this individual take natokinase and have it break down a clot that everyone, you know, a vascular surgeon, everybody else had told him is hey, it's not going anywhere. I will say, this individual with cancer and acute heart failure, put him right away on your protocol. His heart function was so poor, you'd need a heart transplant. And a month and a half after being on the protocol, I told Dr. Corey this. I said, you know, mom called me ecstatic, saying his heart function is completely normal and there's no permanent damage. And I absolutely believe it was because of the protocol, because nothing else was done that could explain the improvement in heart function.
Great. So we have one doctor, Dr. Robert Benson, wants to know, did you or do you order vitamin D levels on the troops during COVID?
Wait, can I answer one answer? Yeah. 'Cause I think I know this fact. Well, I would argue, why would you order a vitamin D level? Because pilots can't take vitamin D. Is that correct? Did I get that right?
I don't think
it's not on the restricted
list. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I'm misinformed. That's why I wanted to check with you. I did
probably 8 deployments downrange with a large medical package. And so, we did look at vitamin D on return as we were trying to figure out why we were having such a problem with some of the just PTSD just went through the roof, right? And these guys, but you have to remember that we fight at night and we're up all night long and you're in a stressful environment. Cortisol levels are through the roof, right? And we are covered. Everybody says, well, it's sunny there. Why aren't, you know, but we're not tanning, you know, in Afghanistan. So, we're covered. We got gloves on. We got helmets on, you know, all this stuff. And guys were coming in extremely low on vitamin D, extremely low, extremely high on, check this one out, lead. So we do lead levels and we would be high on lead. Now we get lead levels that are high in the shooting ranges, picking up ammo and things like that. But in Afghanistan and certain other places that still have leaded gasoline and you're operating in an area that's the Bagram, which is a bowl, you're breathing in that for 6 months at a time. And they would come in and we'd get the KXRF on the lower extremities. We'd have to chelate them with the, you know, a BAL. So those are the things we saw, but with the vitamin D, that was it. There was extremely low and it did affect our guys. And then of course, now we're getting, the numbers that are coming in getting vaxxed, now we can compare that when they're coming back, we see a huge jump in just empirically. I don't have the numbers, but in the injuries. But these are, I came directly from Africa and went to the border, a deployment where I was completely.
Anyway, hit. Teresa and Doc, we want to thank you, from the bottom of my heart, what you've been doing and the service that you provide. And, just keep doing what you can do. We can only support our servicemen. And thank you.
Oh,
yeah. I appreciate that. I want to say this, I ask people, please do not be careful where you send your donations, right? There are people that are actually landing punches and doing good work. And there are people who are just out there with a lot of talk and a lot of hot air, and they're not doing anything. I think FLCCC, very solid. Pierre, you guys have helped me on so many cases. Just want people to know that they have never balked at helping me with service members who are injured, and I tremendously appreciate that. And I want to
give a thank you too, because we're at the tip of the spear downrange, and for me, a lot of time, 6 years of my kid's life, and in terrible places, and missed a lot. But without guys like you that are back here looking at the information, getting it to us, I couldn't fully advise them with any real confirmation. That saved lives. I mean, you were part of saving lives because they didn't take it. My numbers were abysmal as far as the numbers that took it to the military. That looked bad to me. All of us saved more lives of soldiers by informing than I ever did by putting my hand in some kid's guts downrange and being a plumber.
That's a partnership. That's a team. I mean, if we put forth the information because we had a way to do that, you listen, and you're the one who insisted on informed consent. I mean, without you, none of what we put out would have impact. So right. I appreciate what you
let
guys
me tell you something. It is a huge blessing when I can see somebody who's really sick and say, hey, I have a Rolodex of some of the best and brightest doc. I'm not the smartest doctor, but I know some of the smartest doctors, and they'll take my phone call, and that is. It's huge. It's huge.
A lot.
It means a lot to me. Yeah. Really.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all you're doing, all of you. Thank you. And folks, we have a few announcements for you. In continuing to honor our veterans, this month we are going to be hosting an FLCCC Twitter space or X space, whatever they call it now, titled The Military Vaccine Mandates and Impacts, again featuring Lieutenant Colonel Teresa Chambers, as well as analyst and advocate for service members Sam Shoemate and former Lieutenant Colonel Brad Miller. Mark your calendars for that. It's going to be Tuesday, November the 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern time, and set a reminder for the space with the link on screen. Now, we have to tell you that next week we're not going to have a webinar because of the Thanksgiving holiday. We're also not going to have a news capsule next week because of the Thanksgiving holiday. We'll be spending time with our friends and family and getting ready for a Thanksgiving dinner Wednesday night. So we wish you and yours a wonderful holiday with delicious food and great company. And we will be back the following week, November 29th, for a discussion with special guest Warner Mendenhall on Call in the Lawyers. We will see you right back here, same time, same place, for that discussion. But we have a few other things to tell you. Do keep your calendars out, because our third FLCCC Educational Conference is just around the corner. Join us February 2nd to 4th at 2024 in Phoenix for Healthcare Revolution, Restoring the Doctor-Patient Relationship, and help us to do just that. Early bird registration is open now, so please visit flccc.net/conference to learn more or save a seat today, and make sure to share it with your friends, your family, and hey, maybe even your personal physician. Okay, we have more to share. Our doctors have been busy. We have Dr. Bean's episode of Long Story Short shares a new study out of Germany demonstrating that mRNA shots cause long-term changes in the immune profile, and that individuals who fail to accommodate these changes can end up with vaccine injuries. Scary, but important information. And Dr. Liz Mumper has a new episode of Kids Corner discussing RSV vaccines and children. You don't want to miss that one either, and please make sure to share it with all in your life who are parents of young children. All right, both episodes can be found on our FLCCC Alliance Rumble and Odyssey channels or on our website at flccc.net/Dr. Bean and Kids Corner. I do need to tell you about our guides. We have another incredible doctor, naturopath Dr. Christina Carmen, has helped us create three new guides on nattokinase, lumbrokinase, and serrapeptase. Learn more about these wonderful enzymes with easy-to-understand printable infographics. You can find them on our website under the Tools and Guides tab or use the links on the screen. And with that, let's move to our nurses, Christina Maros, our CRNA. And Christina, anybody else on with you tonight, or did you have to do this one yourself?
No, Emily's around.
Emily's around too. Okay, there you are. Thank you for being here and handling questions. Were you able to handle many? You know, that discussion was just riveting. I'm not sure I could have taken my ears away from that. But how did it go?
It went well. Me and Emily just want to make sure that any vaccine injured military know that they can reach out to us for help at clinical@flccc.net. Anybody in the military who needs help finding resources, please reach out to us.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. And please do check them out. And we wish you a happy Thanksgiving as well. Folks, speaking of giving thanks, we want to thank you. You know, before we've said it before, but we're going to say it again. We couldn't do any of this without you. Back at home, back wherever you are, your continuing words of encouragement, your ongoing support makes everything we do possible. So thank you. Thank you. We will leave you with the same video as earlier because, well, we are so excited about Phoenix in 2024. We have that nice little video that just was finished. We wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. We will all be giving thanks again at our homes for all that you do. We will see you in 2 weeks. Meantime, good night.
This is the battle to try to restore medicine to its original purpose.
The goal of all of this is just central to what we do. I mean, we're trying to help patients.
This is my favorite conference I've ever been to. And I've been practicing for 25 years.
This is the population of people that is creating a functional healthcare system parallel to the healthcare system that has failed us.